You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Lizzo by Lisa Robinson, with photos by Campbell Addy, styled by Patty Wilson. Her mother, who brought Lizzo up in a religious home, says, when she started out, she didn't use profanity at all. She got the family together, took us to a therapy session, and explained to us that she would be using profanity in her songs. She prepared us for it. She was always a free spirit and didn't like clothes, so that was not a surprise at all. She is doing what she loves to do, making her own decisions and really helping people along the way. I'm so proud of her. I ask Lizzo where she is most comfortable. In my bed, she says. Alone? I don't like to be alone, she admits. I like to be around people. She posts online only what she wants to post, and is determined to keep a lot of her life private. But it was recently revealed, and not by her, that she's in a relationship with Mike Wright, whom she describes as a comedian, actor, musician, and artist. She calls the, quote, news bizarre because it wasn't an official red carpet, and the online photo was taken with someone's iPhone. Still, she tells me, I've known him for over 6 years. He's everything. We're just in love, and that's it. After the relationship became public, she talked on radio show The Breakfast Club about how she didn't believe in monogamy. Is monogamy a religion? She asked me rhetorically. People fight for monogamy like they pray to it every day. I am not a polyamorous person. I'm not in love with multiple partners. That is not me. He's the love of my life. We are life mates. Do I want to get married? If I wanted to start a business with him, I'd get married, because that's when your finances come together. I like weddings. I would like to have a wedding over a marriage. I'm not thinking about sex when I think about monogamy and rules. I'm thinking about the autonomy and independence of him and me. How wonderful would it be to be this complete, independent person and to come together to make two complete independent people. Not that whole, you complete me, you're my other half. No, I'm whole, and you're incredible too. We're like the mirror image of each other. We're connected. But that doesn't mean I was incomplete when I met him. Many musicians have told me they miss all the normal things they did pre-fame, grocery shopping, going to the dry cleaners and such. Lizzo has no such regrets. Hell no, I worked at the grocery store. I pushed carts in the winter at King Supers, a grocery store in Aurora, Colorado. I used to go to the grocery store all the MFing time. I used to get quarters and go to the lavanderia to wash my MFing clothes. I've done all these things. I had very normal formative years. She says she doesn't know a lot of celebrity musicians and doesn't have a lot of friends because, she tells me, I've had a pretty reckless abandon when it's come to cities I've lived in and relationships and careers, leaving and moving on. There's my family and only a few friends I've held on to, SZA and my best friend Alexia Apaya, who I've known since fourth grade. There is a certain comfort being around someone who's known you since you were 9. Alexia Apaya says, it's been a blessing to have maintained a good friend this long. I feel like once she became more popular, she's become way more confident and outspoken when it comes to standing up to people who are doing us wrong. Also, she's more protective of her family and friends and won't put up with disrespect. Other than that, she is still the same sweet, funny girl I grew up with. And according to the Grammy-winning, Oscar-nominated SZA, I was hella enamored by Lizzo and her power. We just hit it off. She's always been a safe space for me to take my wig and my makeup off and be butt naked and vulnerable. She's so much fun, but she's also serious and thoughtful. She's got huge divine mother energy. I'll be crying and laying on her chest at times, but also twerking in her backyard. She's just a gift to the earth and humanity. We're all so blessed to experience her in this lifetime. Other than musicians, Lizzo says she wasn't influenced by a lot of people, but was into fantasy and read a lot of Tolkien. She's unsure about a second season of Watch Out for the Big Girls. We made a good thing, let it stay, she tells me, but that being said, I don't know. She's currently on a 26-city North American tour, and there's an HBO Max documentary expected this year that chronicles the behind-the-scenes of her life and recording sessions. In contrast to her bold red carpet couture, Gautier Balenciaga, she favors her own Yiddy shapewear line for every day. Yiddy is another childhood nickname, and says she was grateful when Kim Kardashian's Skims line came out, because it validated what she'd been trying to tell people for years. So in March of 2022, Lizzo announced her deal with Fabletics, and now all sorts of Yiddy undergarments and clothes will be sold online, in pop-up stores, and in malls. Early in her career, Lizzo performed to empty rooms, but considered them paid rehearsals. She says she was embarrassed only once, when her mother came to see her and no one was in the audience. But her mother remembers it differently. She did have a small fan base, of 5 or 6 people, she says, and I was there with a few friends, so it didn't seem empty from my perspective. I felt so proud of her unique style. I had never heard anything like it before. She sang with her whole heart and soul. Everyone there enjoyed it. We were dancing and having a wonderful time. Lizzo adds, I always had a very in-the-moment understanding that this was the story, this was the journey. This ain't it. This is why a lot of people get effed up. They're experiencing their life as this is it. And it's just part of the story that I'm going to look back on and remember when I played and nobody was there. But I always played my shows to the one person I could see. We talk about the criticism that disturbs her the most, that she makes music for a white audience. That is probably the biggest criticism I've received, and it is such a critical conversation when it comes to black artists. When black people see a lot of white people in the audience, they think, well, this isn't for me, this is for them. The thing is, when a black artist reaches a certain level of popularity, it's going to be a predominantly white crowd. I was so startled when I watched YouTube clips of gospel great Sister Rosetta Tharpe, who was an innovator of rock and roll. She was like, I'm going to take gospel and shred guitar. And when they turned the camera around, it was a completely white audience. Tina Turner, when she played arenas, white audience. This has happened to so many black artists, Diana Ross, Whitney, Beyoncé. Rap artists now, those audiences are overwhelmingly white. I am not making music for white people. I am a black woman. I am making music from my black experience, for me to heal myself from the experience we call life. If I can help other people, hell yeah, because we are the most marginalized and neglected people in this country. We need self-love, and self-love anthems more than anybody. So am I making music for that girl right there who looks like me, who grew up in a city where she was underappreciated and picked on and made to feel unbeautiful? Yes. It blows my mind when people say I'm not making music from a black perspective. How could I not do that as a black artist? And she says internet criticism bothered her until she got into the real world and connected with black women who told her that her music inspired them. The more her music became mainstream, she tells me, the more she started to connect with people who see her for who she really is. Not that girl, she's always happy, it's not real. But instead, she's really good and her music is good. Believe her. That is what I'm moving into now, and it's a beautiful place to be. I finally feel I can relax and have a cocktail. Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. Julie Taymor, the visionary director, on the 25th anniversary of The Lion King, The Power of Travel, and Her Fear of Hippos. When and where were you happiest? Collaborating with great artists on theater, opera, and film projects. What is your greatest regret? How much time I sit in front of a computer. What or who is the greatest love of your life? Elliot Goldenthal, my partner in art and life. What is your idea of perfect happiness? A fall day on the beach with Elliot and my dog Luna and the sea, sand, and sky. What is your current state of mind? Vacillating between excitement about the beauty of nature, future projects, hope for positive change, and utter disgust for the abuse of nature, cynicism about the reality of getting dream projects off the ground, and a nagging fear that humans are bent on destruction. What do you most value in your friends? Love of fun and food and great conversation. What is your favorite journey? The 3 months I planned on traveling to Indonesia and the 4 unplanned years I spent there after. In Africa, sleeping in the Kalahari Desert, landing on a grass strip amid a herd of elephants, floating down the Okavango Delta in a hollowed-out tree trunk, terrified of the hippos. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? A misunderstood and misused virtue is honor. It can easily transform into a weapon to abuse and control others. What do you consider your greatest achievement? When the work I have done in theater or film has touched people in such a way that it has brought them through the darkest moments and spiritually touched their lives. During the long run of The Lion King, people have told me that the show helped them and their child deal with the death in the family. It is the shamanistic spiritual side of the art form that most inspires me. Who are your favorite writers? Salman Rushdie, Charles Dickens, Toni Morrison, Shakespeare. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Erica Jong's Fanny Hackabout Jones. Who are your heroes in real life? My mother, Betty Taymor, Gloria Steinem, Frida Kahlo. What is it that you most dislike? Idiots in positions of power. How would you like to die? When I am ready. When I have had enough. When I can no longer give anything. When I can no longer appreciate the small beauties. Without pain or remorse. What is your motto? I believe in bringing people to places they didn't know they wanted to go. If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? A cloud, raining on those who need the water and those whom I just want to drench. Protecting people from the harshness of the sun and transforming into all shapes. I could disappear and leave not a trace behind, and at sunset I could cause the most magical painting across the skies. And that was the Proust Questionnaire with Julie Taymor.
Thank you.
the rise of the Ronald. Ron DeSantis is the polished, competent, Fox-loving, lib-owning successor-in-waiting to Donald Trump's MAGA nation. Is it any wonder they're locked in a 2024 Cold War? By Gabriel Sherman. Opening illustration shows DeSantis and his wife at an event, Red Star Rising. Ron DeSantis's growing political power flows from the fact that he is equally popular with the donor class and a GOP base that has otherwise shown utmost fealty to Donald Trump. On the afternoon of August 19th, several hundred conservative activists streamed into the ballroom at the Wyndham Grand Hotel in downtown Pittsburgh. The grassroots event was billed as a Unite and Win rally for Doug Mastriano, the Donald Trump-backed Pennsylvania gubernatorial candidate who was campaigning on Trump's big lie that Democrats stole the 2020 election. But Mastriano was only the warm-up act for the headliner, who had drawn me and members of the National Press Corps to Pennsylvania, Ron DeSantis. The first-time Florida governor strutted on stage in a boxy suit and red tie, flinging white Ron DeSantis baseball caps into the sea of unmasked faces. The sound system blasted Sweet Florida, a country tribute anthem the Lynyrd Skynyrd adjacent band Van Zant wrote for him. The music rapped, and the crowd quieted. DeSantis gripped the lectern. He offered cursory praise for Mastriano, and then uncorked a grievance-fueled stump speech that sounded like it had been written by AI, plugged into Fox News. In DeSantis's telling, the honest people of Florida were besieged by a vast array of liberal scourges, big tech, IRS agents, George Soros, the Biden administration, the corporate media, illegal immigrants, Anthony Fauci, police defunders, Disney, China, communism, cancel culture, critical race theory, and woke gender ideology. Only Ron DeSantis was brave enough to confront these malign forces. "I'll tell you this, the state of Florida is where woke goes to die," he vowed, to thunderous applause. DeSantis's appearance in the Keystone State made headlines not for what he said, but for what he didn't. Anything nice about Donald Trump. The omission was one of the many signs that the 44-year-old is preparing a run for president in 2024. In February, Rupert Murdoch-owned HarperCollins signed DeSantis to a lucrative book deal, and this was a year ago, which the governor could use to publish his national platform next year. This summer, DeSantis campaigned for candidates in two more key swing states, Arizona and Ohio, and has amassed a sizable war chest. According to disclosures, DeSantis has raised a record-breaking $172 million since August 2019. His Democratic opponent, Charlie Crist, has raised just $15.3 million. DeSantis has burnished his national profile by granting frequent interviews to Fox News. According to the liberal watchdog group Media Matters, DeSantis made more than 200 appearances since 2017 on the network. "Ron has done a fantastic job courting Fox talent. It's a big deal to him," a former DeSantis advisor told me. The mainstream media gets no such love. The organizers of DeSantis's Pennsylvania speech required reporters to submit clips of previous articles, ostensibly to vet them, though this took on a more authoritarian tone given the two candidates' open wars with the mainstream press. Of course, any path to the 2024 GOP nomination almost certainly runs through Trump. According to two sources briefed on Trump's plans, the former president considered announcing he was running over the July 4th holiday, but decided to wait. According to a source, Trump told advisors he worried he could be damaged politically if Republicans underperform in the midterms. He'd rather blame Mitch McConnell for a loss than himself, a Republican briefed on Trump's thinking told me. Discussions in Trump world about a campaign announcement were active as this article went to press, which means the DeSantis-Trump rivalry will remain the most closely watched storyline in Republican politics heading into the 2024 GOP primary. In July, a New York Times Siena College poll found more than half of GOP voters would vote for someone other than Trump in 2024. A University of North Florida poll conducted from August 8th through August 12th showed DeSantis beating Trump in a 2024 primary 47% to 45%. DeSantis's political power flows from the fact that he is equally popular with the donor class and a GOP base that has otherwise shown utmost fealty to Trump. Billionaires like Citadel founder Ken Griffin and real estate mogul and Miami Dolphins owner Stephen Ross love DeSantis's elite credentials, Yale, Harvard, the Navy, and his deregulatory zeal. He's Trump without the insanity and the tweets at 3 a.m, one top GOP donor told me. DeSantis has caught a moment where he's a stark contrast to Trump's crazy governing style, and he's doing it from a MAGA state, said longtime Republican strategist Scott Reed. He's got two of the best assets. He can raise money, and he has a message. MAGA voters love that DeSantis has made owning the libs and attacking the media a raison d'etre of his governorship. DeSantis declined to comment for this story. So far, the DeSantis-Trump smackdown has been unfolding off-camera, but it likely won't stay that way. DeSantis in private trashes Trump. He calls him a TV personality and a moron who has no business running for president, a former DeSantis staffer said. DeSantis tells donors that if he takes on Trump, he would launch a full frontal attack on his record and competence, according to a GOP source briefed on the conversations. DeSantis says the only way to beat Trump is to attack him head on. He says he would turn to Trump during a debate and say, "Why didn't you fire Fauci? You said you would build the wall, but there is no wall. Why is that?" Trump, meanwhile, vents about DeSantis constantly, according to people who speak with him. Trump says he's overrated, disloyal, and a know-nothing, a Trump friend told me. Trump's animus is fueled by his not incorrect belief that he put DeSantis in the governor's mansion. In conversations, Trump reminds people that then-Congressman DeSantis was losing by double digits during the 2018 gubernatorial primary until Trump backed him. Sources said it galls Trump that DeSantis hasn't acknowledged the boost Trump provided, aside from a cursory acknowledgement in his victory speech. Trump tells people, "I made Ron," a prominent Republican said. Trump says that about a lot of people, but in this case, it's actually true. It's not just Trump that DeSantis has alienated. The biggest complaint you hear about DeSantis is that he never says thank you, a veteran GOP strategist said. People host events where donors give him enormous sums of money, and he never says thank you. While reporting this profile, more than a dozen GOP donors, elected officials, and former DeSantis staffers predicted that DeSantis's combative temperament would be a serious liability if exposed to the white-hot glare of a presidential campaign. People described DeSantis's personality as a mix of extreme arrogance and painful awkwardness. "He's missing the sociability gene," a prominent Republican said, relaying an oft-stated critique. "He doesn't do the warm and fuzzies well. I was at a fundraiser in D.C. where he was like 2 hours late. Everyone was like, 'What the F?'" recalled a GOP strategist. DeSantis's offices have earned a reputation as a very unhappy place to work. "When you work for Ron, he makes you feel like you're just lucky to be there," a former gubernatorial aide said. "I once had to drive him to the airport. We got stuck in traffic for an hour, and he didn't say a word, a former congressional staffer told me. I describe him as having the personality of a piece of paper. Last year, Politico reported ex-DeSantis staffers had formed a support group to commiserate over their bruising experiences. He's a terrible bully, a past advisor said. The Herculean job of smoothing DeSantis' rough edges and repairing relationships falls to one person, his wife, Casey. A former local newscaster, Casey is by far DeSantis' closest confidant and advisor, multiple sources said. The only person he listens to is Casey, a former congressional staffer said. DeSantis consults her on everything from hiring decisions and media appearances to policy positions and wardrobe choices. She's been known to write thank you cards and make phone calls on his behalf. She is his emotional tuning fork, a former congressional staffer said. Several sources compared her influence to that of the most famous Republican political spouse in recent memory, Nancy Reagan. But no one would mistake Ron DeSantis for Ronald Reagan, the former actor with an innate sense of his audience. Which means DeSantis's political future hinges on the following question: can he lead the Trump cult of personality with no personality? Over the past 2 years, DeSantis turned Florida into the crucible of the culture wars. His governing philosophy wasn't about a particular set of policies or making voters' lives better. It was about winning. And in a post-Trump GOP, the measure of winning is whether Democrats and the media are outraged. He banned mask and vaccine mandates during the depths of the COVID-19 pandemic. He signed the controversial Don't Say Gay law that barred teachers from mentioning sexual orientation in elementary schools. DeSantis Press Secretary Christina Pushaw tweeted that Democrats who opposed the legislation were groomers. When Disney, under pressure from its LGBTQ plus employees, lobbied against the law, DeSantis stripped the company of long-standing tax breaks. He recently suspended an elected state prosecutor who said he wouldn't criminalize abortion. DeSantis summed up his record to the crowd in Pittsburgh. We didn't just sit idly by, hoping that issues didn't come on our desk. We went on offense. It's surprising DeSantis has become Trump's heir apparent, because their backgrounds are so divergent. DeSantis grew up in middle class in the Tampa suburb of Dunedin. His mother, Karen, worked as a nurse, and his father, Ron, installed Nielsen television boxes. Trump was an unruly real estate scion, shipped off to military school at 13 by his father. DeSantis was an academic star and baseball phenom. He pitched and played third base on the Dunedin team that made it to the Little League World Series in 1991. Trump came to politics late in life. DeSantis harbored presidential ambitions from an early age. But DeSantis and Trump share a core quality that propelled them through their careers. They're both outsiders with a chip on their shoulder. DeSantis enrolled at Yale in the fall of 1997. He majored in history, captained the baseball team, and pledged the then jock fraternity Delta Kappa Epsilon, whose alumni include both President Bush's and Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Classmates remembered DeSantis, who went by the nickname RD, as intensely ambitious and careful. He was aloof, a frat brother told me. He wasn't the guy in there doing the hazing. He would be like, "You pledges suck." Then he would be off on his own. He was smart enough to protect his image. Even those who disliked DeSantis respected his intellect. He's a calculated, cold-blooded dude, but he's a very smart guy, the frat brother said. DeSantis graduated with honors and enrolled at Harvard Law School. A friend told The New Yorker that DeSantis was inspired to join the Navy during law school after watching the film A Few Good Men, in which Tom Cruise plays a crusading lawyer in the Judge Advocate General's Corps. DeSantis graduated in 2005 and became a JAG. He worked with Al-Qaeda detainees at Guantanamo Bay and earned a Bronze Star, serving as a lawyer with Navy SEALs in Iraq. Back stateside, DeSantis was stationed in Mayport, Florida, near Jacksonville. He continued to attract a reputation for being hyper-aggressive and standoffish. Several former JAG officers I spoke to recall DeSantis as having a zero-sum game approach to his career. In the winter of 2010, DeSantis took a job at a Jacksonville law firm. Around this time, his bachelor life came to an end. While playing a round of golf at the University of North Florida's course, DeSantis struck up a conversation with a petite woman with dark hair that gave her a slight resemblance to Anne Hathaway. A news anchor for the Jacksonville station WJXT, Casey Black was socially ambitious and politically conservative. I remember I once said to a colleague, "Casey wants to be a senator's wife," and he said, "No, she fully intends on being a president's wife," a former WJXT staffer recalled. Dan Brown, a past arts editor of the Jacksonville Alternative Weekly, remembered being shocked by Casey's partisanship when he appeared on her show. While he discussed upcoming concert listings in the area, she ripped the paper in two because she didn't like its headline about Republicans. "I was there to pitch a metal band, and she ripped up my paper on screen. I was flustered," Brown told me. I remember she looked at the paper and said, "What do you call this?" I said something like, "It's freedom of the press, sister," according to Brown. Casey's producer called and apologized profusely. DeSantis and Casey were married in September 2010. That November, the Tea Party wave, whipped up by Fox News, swept the country. Republicans won a net 63 seats in Congress, the biggest national partisan swing since 1948. In 2012, DeSantis ran for Florida's 6th congressional district. Casey was instrumental to the campaign. According to a source, Casey capitalized on her local celebrity to introduce DeSantis to power brokers in North Florida. "She squired him around to all the powers that be," the source said. DeSantis's politics at the time leaned libertarian. He cared about small government, balanced budgets, and the Constitution. Ron was obsessed with James Madison. We'd have to write a statement, and he'd say, "I want to see a quote from James Madison," a former staffer recalled. But DeSantis also harbored the reactionary streak that now dominates the Republican Party. The thesis of his 2011 book, Dreams from Our Founding Fathers, a rebuke of Barack Obama's best-selling memoir, Dreams from My Father, argued that Obama's entire agenda was inimical to the Constitution. DeSantis won the seat, and Casey became a de facto member of his staff. She was looped in on every email and calendar invite. "If Casey said jump, we would pull out the trampoline," recalled a former congressional staffer. At least once, a staffer didn't even meet the congressman before starting. "Casey interviewed me over the phone. I met Ron on my first day. It was weird," one former staffer recalled. Casey's biggest influence was using her skills as a TV anchor to burnish DeSantis's media image. "We had to buy his own earpiece and mic," she wanted. She bought him these dumbass cowboy boots because she thought it was part of the image. "She made sure we picked the right ties," the former staffer said. A then WJXT colleague noted that Casey gave DeSantis training on the station's teleprompter. DeSantis's focus on television was prescient. Ron was obsessed with Fox. That's how he got on Trump's radar, a former advisor said. Multiple Republicans who interacted with DeSantis told me DeSantis began tailoring his policies to appeal to Fox viewers. His first question was always, "How will that play on Fox?" "If you give an opinion he doesn't like," he says, "I don't think that will play well on Fox," a prominent Republican said. Fox was on in the office 24/7. Ron made it abundantly clear he would only do Fox, a former staffer remembered. Getting Ron booked on Hannity was a high priority, another former DeSantis staffer said. According to a source, DeSantis texted with Hannity and Fox host Laura Ingraham. In 2015, DeSantis was among a group of 9 Republican House members who founded the hard-right Freedom Caucus. He courted the group's then-chairman, Ohio Congressman Jim Jordan. Jim would call Ron from across the room, and Ron would go running over, the former DeSantis staffer recalled. But DeSantis was dismissive of his peers. Ron didn't respect Mark Meadows. I could see it in the way they interacted, a former staffer said. Ron hated Kevin McCarthy. Same with Boehner. He thought he was smarter than them, a former staffer said. DeSantis was particularly turned off by social conservatives like then-Utah Congressman Jason Chaffetz. He also thought the Freedom Caucus guys were all nuts, a former staffer recalled. Ron had a Do Not Disturb sign, and he'd put it on his door anytime Chaffetz was coming by the office, another staffer said. A one-time staffer told me the sign, when hung, applied to all staff and visitors. Safe. Save for Casey. Like many elected Republicans, DeSantis was appalled when Trump ran for president. Ron made more fun of Donald Trump than anyone I know, one of the former DeSantis staffers told me. He thought Trump was effing nuts, said another. Two staffers remembered DeSantis was particularly shocked by Trump's appearance at the Republican Jewish Coalition meeting in Washington in December 2015. This room negotiates, perhaps more than any room I've spoken to, maybe more, Trump told the audience. Ron came back to the office and said, I can't believe Trump said that. Then we pulled up old Saturday Night Live videos of Trump doing Domino's pizza commercials and stood around the computer making fun of Trump for 30 minutes. DeSantis pivoted after the 2016 election. He hung out at Trump's Washington hotel, pushed a bill to defund the Mueller investigation, and shilled on Fox News. I liked him because he was out there defending me very strongly on the Mueller hoax, Trump told me in an interview last year. In November 2017, DeSantis earned an invitation to fly with Trump on Air Force One to a rally in Pensacola, Florida. DeSantis's congressional staff lamented his transformation. Ron is one of the smartest people I've come in contact with. He had such potential, but he became nothing but a Trump suck-up. It's really sad, a former staffer told me. Ron is an intellectual, and then there's this persona. He's a populist-like Trump figure, which is very clearly crafted, another said. DeSantis' MAGA makeover paid off when he ran for governor in 2018. During the GOP primary, Trump gave DeSantis 2 endorsements and propelled DeSantis to close a 17-point deficit on the frontrunner, the state's moderate agriculture commissioner, Adam Putnam. Ron went through the roof as soon as I endorsed him, Trump said. A month before the primary, DeSantis aired a campaign ad that showed him reading Trump's Art of the Deal to his infant son, Mason, and encouraging his toddler daughter, Madison, to build a wall with toy blocks. DeSantis beat Putnam by 20 points. DeSantis yoked himself even tighter to Trump when he faced Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum in the general election. DeSantis's campaign went sideways out of the gate when he told a Fox News interviewer, "The last thing we need to do is to monkey this up by electing Gillum, who would have become Florida's first black governor." DeSantis insisted the apparent racist dog whistle was unintentional and privately blamed his staff for failing to clean up the controversy. He has a hard time taking responsibility for anything that goes wrong, a member of the campaign said. A month before the election, polls were deadlocked. To right the ship, DeSantis hired Trump's 2016 Florida campaign chief, Susie Wiles, to run his campaign. Meanwhile, a parade of MAGA royalty campaigned for DeSantis, who defeated Gillum by 30,000 votes. Trump dragged Ron across the finish line, a longtime Trump advisor told me. A rift between the two men opened almost immediately. DeSantis seems to be making the political calculation that whether Trump runs in 2024 or not, the 76-year-old former president has an expiration date. Trump's list of legal and political liabilities continues to grow. During the week of August 8th alone, the FBI raided Mar-a-Lago to retrieve hundreds of government documents, more than 100 highly classified, Trump allegedly took from the White House. A Manhattan judge ordered Trump's company to stand trial in October for criminal tax fraud, and New York Attorney General Letitia James deposed Trump in her long-running investigation into his business practices. The first flashpoint was a personal feud that exploded between DeSantis and Wiles. In September 2019, DeSantis went ballistic after the Tampa Bay Times published embarrassing fundraising memos that revealed his Wiles-led political action committee wanted to charge lobbyists $25,000 to play golf with the governor. Sources said Casey told DeSantis that Wiles couldn't be trusted. Wiles denied being the source of the leak. DeSantis was unconvinced. According to a source, DeSantis leaned on Wiles' business partner, Brian Ballard, to oust her from her lobbying firm. Ballard has denied this. DeSantis called Trump's then-campaign manager, Brad Parscale, and demanded that Trump's re-election campaign exile Wiles. DeSantis also reportedly told donors not to give money to Trump's 2020 convention, then being prepped in Jacksonville, because Wiles was involved in planning it. At one point, according to sources, Wiles was so distraught by DeSantis' efforts to ruin her reputation that she hired a former FBI agent to give her a polygraph test so she could prove she wasn't behind the fundraising memo leak. She tried to get a meeting with DeSantis to show him the results, but he refused to see her, a source said. "He's scary," said a former staffer. At the same time, DeSantis was still extracting political favors from Trump. According to two sources, DeSantis announced publicly in the fall of 2019 that Trump would attend the Florida GOP's annual statesman's dinner before the White House had signed off on the invitation, which effectively forced Trump to appear. Not that DeSantis returned the favor. Throughout 2019, DeSantis turned down interview requests from Fox News, in part, a source close to DeSantis said, because DeSantis didn't want to defend Trump's erratic behavior in office. According to Media Matters, DeSantis made just 3 Fox News appearances in all of 2019, down from 81 in 2018. Next photo, Lady MAGA. A former local newscaster, Casey DeSantis, is by far her husband's closest confidant and advisor, smoothing his rough edges and repairing relationships. And she's shown with him in formal dress walking across a room. COVID-19 emboldened DeSantis to further challenge Trump, staking out ground on his right flank in his response to the pandemic, opening schools, banning local mask mandates, and barring employer-backed vaccine requirements. He attended a press conference with an anti-vaxxer who falsely claimed vaccines change your RNA and appointed vaccine skeptic Joseph Ladapo to be the state's surgeon general. He bullied a group of high school students on camera to remove their mask during a press event. In December 2021, a crowd booed Trump during an onstage interview with Bill O'Reilly when Trump revealed he had gotten a booster shot. At a press conference a few weeks later, DeSantis declined to say if he'd received one because he didn't want it to be a weapon for people to use. Trump made a veiled attack on DeSantis during an interview with One America News when he said politicians who refuse to disclose their vaccine status are gutless. Bucking public health orthodoxy turned DeSantis into a folk hero among his base. One true believer was Christina Pashaw, a 30-year-old staffer at Charles Koch's Washington, D.C. nonprofit Stand Together. On March 19, 2021, Pashaw sent a mash note to DeSantis's press secretary asking for a job, wanting, she wrote, to fight against pervasive false narratives and prevent the devastation caused by socialism from happening in our country, according to the Tampa Bay Times, which obtained a copy of the email. Pashaw had already shown she could troll for DeSantis. A month earlier, she published an article on the conservative news site Human Events that defended DeSantis's COVID policies and savaged the media's coverage of Rebecca Jones, a Florida Health Department employee who claimed she was fired for refusing to manipulate COVID data. The state said Jones was let go for insubordination. On Twitter, Pashaw took it to another level. According to screenshots, Pashaw's since-deleted tweets called Jones an unstable grifter, a pathological liar, and fatal attraction level obsessed with her. DeSantis liked what he saw. In May 2021, he hired Pashaw. Since then, Pashaw has become the tip of the outrage spear in DeSantis's media strategy. Her Twitter feed is laced with obscene allegations and incendiary language. During her first 6 weeks on the job, Pashaw fired off 3,800 tweets, the Tampa Bay Times reported. In August 2021, Twitter locked her account for 12 hours after she reportedly sent 200 tweets about an Associated Press reporter story during an 18-hour period that led to online threats. In January 2022, Pashaw suggested a small neo-Nazi rally in Orlando was a false flag by Democrats who wanted to damage DeSantis. She became best known when, during the debate over the so-called Don't Say Gay law, she tweeted, "If you're against the anti-grooming bill, you're probably a groomer, or at least you don't denounce the grooming of 4 to 8-year-old children." "Silence is complicity. This is how it works, Democrats, and I didn't make the rules." Pashaw was nervous the tweet crossed a line with DeSantis, according to a source who spoke with her at the time. The governor was thrilled. In August, she moved to his reelection campaign to oversee its rapid response. DeSantis's anti-media views have been hardening for years. In August 2013, he gave an interview with CNN's Jake Tapper. The six-minute segment was civil, but Ron didn't like the way Jake conducted it, a former staffer said. DeSantis stopped giving access to CNN. Since then, DeSantis has cocooned himself inside the right-wing media bubble. It's a strategy that, in large part, assumes he doesn't need to speak to independents or Democrats. In July, DeSantis headlined the Florida GOP's Sunshine Summit, and the Florida GOP refused to grant access to reporters from the Washington Post, the New York Times, Politico, the Palm Beach Post, and the Miami Herald. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.